Well, thanks, Luke, and thank you for the invitation to come and worship and be with you this morning. I've recently finished a 22-year stint at the Wembley Downs Church of Christ, where Jenny and I were in ministry, and it's been about 4 months where we've been living in that blissful state that they call retirement. I prefer to think of it as refirement. So I'm a little bit rusty this morning. This is the first speaking engagement I've taken since then. But Luke, I'd like to thank you for the way that you led worship this morning and segued very nicely into what I think is the theme that comes out of the text, and that is maintaining our vision, our line of sight in the midst of life's worst struggles. And that's where we're going to go. Just to prepare some ground for that, I noticed yesterday as I was walking around the Joondalup shopping centre, and I was being served by people that were dressed as hobgoblins and witches, and there were broomsticks and cobwebs everywhere. Oh, yeah, Halloween must be this week. And it is Wednesday night. But that always reminds me that the next day is All Saints Day. That's what the word Halloween actually means. It's the eve of All Hallows, the night before we celebrate that great cloud of witnesses, those people in the faith who have gone before. And this week I note the graduation of two of our very prestigious thinking leaders in the Christian faith to that cloud of witnesses. Thomas Keating, who was the foundation leader of the Centering Prayer Movement throughout the world, passed away yesterday, or we had news of his passing away yesterday. And earlier this week, those of you who are aware of the message and the author, Eugene Peterson, and his many works, he passed away also at the age of 85. Now, Eugene Peterson in particular has been something of a mentor of mine. He gave me this pouch that I carry around on occasions, and it has within it five smooth stones that I keep on my desk because they remind me of the tasks of ministry. Eugene Peterson gave us the picture of alluding to that young stripling of a shepherd boy who took five smooth stones out of a creek and slayed the Goliath of his time. He said, well, you know, here's our five smooth stones for pastoral ministry, for mission in the local church, in the local community. There's the stone of story making, the stone of community building, the stone of pain sharing, the stone of naysaying, and the stone of prayer directing. And it's the stone of story making that I want to pick up today and put into the story of Bartimaeus. The story making process is a rather fascinating one. It's discovering, and it's listening to, and it's engaging the stories that we hear from the gospel, both from the view of the human Jesus and the viewpoint of the cosmic Christ, with our own story, with the stories that we hear others telling us, with the stories that we hear in the announcements that were made this morning. How does the gospel of Christ marry itself to each of those? Because the gospel of Christ, we believe, continues to be that great mega story that transcends, embraces, and transforms the postmodern belief in relativity and no ultimate truth. And yet it sits comfortably in our ambiguity and open-endedness. Well, that was a whole lot of big words. Let me illustrate what I mean. When travelling alone, I usually avoid talking to passengers on the flight next to me, because I'm an introvert. That means I get my energy from going within rather than engaging without. I mean, in my line of work, I have to engage with that, but my energy comes from going back within to recharge my batteries, so I'll make sure that I have a book on the plane. I open it very quickly so the person next to me doesn't start talking. But on a recent trip, my Jetstar neighbour showed every sign of wanting to talk, in spite of the book. So I shut my book and we exchanged pleasantries. And he learned that I was visiting family and I learned that he was on a work trip. And then he asked that question, "What do you do?" Now, on my tax returns and forms, I put Minister of Religion. But usually if I say that to someone, it's a bit of a conversation killer. I knew that if I said I was a church minister, the probability was that the conversation would soon be politely aborted. But by now, I was sufficiently engaged to not want this to happen. So remembering something that I'd recently seen on YouTube by a minister who was in a similar predicament, I took his line and I said, "I'm an agent for a global enterprise." We're heavily involved in education, preschool, right through university and beyond. We're at the root of a lot of healthcare, have been for quite a long time. Community wellbeing, personal transformation, we're into all of those things. And we're widespread. We have outlets in just about every suburb and city. And throughout most of the countries in the world. And he said, "Oh, really? Tell me more." Well, by the time we reached our destination, we had discussed our mutual passion for support of parental mental health carers. We had exchanged our business cards and we had arranged for a follow-up meeting back at Dome in Perth when we got back here. And we followed through with that conversation and he learned about my involvement in the church and I learned about his tentative involvement but his interest in the spiritual journey and the conversation went on. Now, had I sold him my story or had he sold me his? It's the wrong question. But was the realm of God at work in our conversation and mutual service to community health care, and did it hold promise for future growth and understanding? That's a better question. And the story was open-ended and it was still being made. So that's the stone of story making. Engaging the big story of the gospel with our individual and unique stories, both the ones that we tell and the ones that we listen to. And it's this stone of story making that we bring to the Mark's rendition of the account of Jesus restoring, the account of Jesus restoring the sight of the sight to Bartimaeus. But why this particular story here at Mount Hawthorn Community Church on Sunday, the 28th of October, 2018. It's because it's on the Revised Common Lectionary. Have you ever heard of that? You know what that is? A lot of churches don't. It is the set of Bible readings in a three-year cycle that many churches internationally follow. And it's the gospel reading that comes up for today. Why do I use the Revised Common Lectionary? It's been my habit right throughout my time in ministry to use that. Basically because it keeps me honest. I mean, it's easy. You don't have to worry about, well, what am I going to say this morning? I'll look up my favourite text and preach on that. And that way I'll get trapped into my hobby horse and I avoid all the difficult passages. But the Revised Common Lectionary sort of gives me a guide. I know, okay, that's what's coming up this Sunday. I find it a very difficult passage to preach on, but I'll have to engage my discipline and work out what it's saying. But apart from that, I like the fact that churches around the world today, as the globe turns, will be waking up and addressing this passage. And there'll be a kind of a solidarity being expressed as we look at this with churches all around the world. I think of places my own journey has taken me and where I can feel just as present now as I was then. The humble slum churches in Mumbai, the vibrant rural gatherings in southern Zimbabwe, the mega churches of Nashville, all of these will be reflecting on the same text. And there's a solidarity on being on this journey together. The other thing is that the three-year cycle fosters a deep engagement with the text. This isn't a new idea, this revised common lectionary. Revised sort of suggests that it's something new. But in this instance, it's going back to the into the treasure house and bringing out something very ancient. It was recently discerned that this was the cycle that was used in the earliest church, revived from ancient church practice in the 4th century. And it opens one secret for which we can engage our story making. And it was Alexander Shire, a recent visitor to Perth, who rediscovered this universal cycle. And it tells the story of our transformation as we go through the 3 years. And it's a story that we can engage with and find the four elements of universal story making in the way that the four Gospels are put together. In fact, Alexander Shire calls his book Heart and Mind the four Gospel journey of radical transformation. And within any story, you'll find that it begins with a summons of some sort. We're being called to something. And in answering that call, we engage with struggle. Struggle not just the normal existential struggle of living, but the struggle that is a result of answering the summons. And in engaging in that struggle, we come through to something of an authenticity, something of a unifying with ourselves, with the others around us, and with our God, which leads us to the fourth element, which is mature service. Now, you find all of these happening in this story in Mark's Gospel from about the healing of Bartimaeus. So let me just run through those elements again. The summons, it's the times where we respond to a call to something that is beyond our half-awake daily routine. Matthew's Gospel in particular addresses the summons. You think of the Sermon on the Mount. You think of the times when Jesus said, you've heard it said this, but I call you now to something deeper, something wider, something more life-engaging, something more lively. And the struggle is, of course, the response that we, in the response that we make to the summons, the risk and danger that is inherent to answering the summons. Mark's Gospel is all about struggle. We'll see that. And there's the theme of breaking boundaries that runs right through Mark. The crossing backwards and forwards across an often stormy sea. Mark's Gospel engages us in that struggle. And then we think of the union, the result of answering the summons, engaging the struggle, brings us to some sort of a union, the integration of something in our life journey that yields exaltation, joy, reward. And we think of John's Gospel, some have called it the Eucharistic Gospel. And then we go back into our ordinary routines with a new authenticity, a new maturity to offer service beyond ourselves, stepping back into our ordinary routine with an authenticity to bring to the service of others. The book of Luke Acts, the road of ministry and mission. So summon, struggle, union, service, all are present in this short, heroic journey at the gates of Jericho. Mark's Gospel was penned against a background of struggle and possibly on the run as the small Christian cohort fled the insane persecution of Nero's Rome. You'll find that Mark's writing is terse, it's hurried, it's anxious, wasting little time as the story unfolds. And it ends abruptly with a woman fleeing the open tomb of the risen Christ in terror, saying nothing to anyone. So the struggle sort of looks as if it remains unresolved in Mark's gospel, unless you look a bit deeper. And the story of Bartimaeus is a key to understanding how to look deeper into the Gospel of Mark. Carlos Gibran said, out of suffering has emerged the strongest souls. The most massive characters are seared with scars. And Mark's Gospel seems to emerge from a communal spirit of defeat and despair. It presents not as a summons to seek out suffering in order to be a hero, but to recognise the inevitability of suffering as part of the journey of human transformation. I love that first song that we had up, by the way, that one out of Ecclesiastes, that sort of explains something of that engagement with the reality of the struggle. Thus holding promise for the Christians who in recent times fled Mosul, who must endure the indignities of persecution in Pakistan, and the new wave of church closures throughout China. These are people around the world who right now are facing these kinds of struggles. But then we have our own story of struggle as well. The struggle is an expected part of our response to the summons of Christ, and we are called to endure it in whatever form it takes for our transformation to proceed. So now the sermon begins. Relax. Let's have a look at the passage. We find ourselves in Jericho. It's the beginning of the path up to Jerusalem and the herald of Jesus' final days. We're on the doorstep of that final journey for Jesus. Our attention is brought to a blind beggar who is mentioned by name. Very few people are mentioned by name in Mark's Gospel. The disciples are. But Bartimaeus is the only one who is healed that is mentioned by name. This may be significant on two counts. What is the nature of the restoration of sight that we are anticipating here? What is the summons as this story begins? What is the significance and nature of Bartimaeus' healing in the midst of this struggle? We get a clue from his name. Bartimaeus, son of Timaeus. Now, this is a bit of a redundancy here because Bartimaeus actually means son of Timaeus. The Aramaic root of the name is somewhat ambiguous in that annoying Middle Eastern way. It can mean two things at the same time. It can mean honour and it can mean shame. Perhaps it's a recognition that we carry both within us. Sometimes we look through the bars of our prison and we see mud. Other times we look through the bars and we see stars. And in times of struggle, it's the shame that overtakes us. It overshadows us. We've lost sight. We're not good enough. And imagine that Christian community fleeing the persecution in Rome, waiting in fear for the knock on the door at midnight, where Caesar's agents would take them away and they would not be seen again. Where is the victory? Where is the confidence? Where is the trust? Where is the faith? Because the shame of fear, the shame of anxiety is there. And the nature of the summons is the call to embrace the honour. That being married to Christ has enlivened within us. The honour with which we are also endowed. When he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to shout out and say, Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. So the summons actually comes from hearing of the presence of Jesus in his vicinity and the initiative that he himself takes, which means that there was a way in which Bartimaeus was already seeing. He already had the vision that here, in the presence of Christ, was the possibility of restoration of sight, the restoration of healing. And he began to shout. Now, rather interesting word for shout. It's in the Greek, it's krazo, something of onomatopoeia in Greek. It sounds like the croak of a raven. I don't know if you've ever heard ravens, but they don't exactly sound sweet. And Mark Davis, who draws our attention to this, says, I wonder if it is somehow related to Caruso to preach. It wouldn't be the last time someone like him preaching to the squawking of a raven. So, but what we get here is that this cry, this shouting out, comes from a very deep guttural place. It's a guttural calling out of deep pain. The well-known pilgrim's prayer in Russian Orthodoxy, the prayer of extremity, when you don't know how to pray, is this very calling out of Bartimaeus. Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. And he addresses Jesus the Nazarene, as he's known of throughout this time in Mark. He addresses him as the son of David. And in doing so, there's both risk and identification here. This was a very dangerous time for Jesus to be being called the son of David. The watchers were out there waiting to pounce. So he was identifying with Jesus. Remember, it's the Christians fleeing Rome that are hearing this for the first time. He's investing himself in risk and identifying with Jesus, the son of Timaeus, in thrall to the son of David. And many sternly ordered him to be quiet, but he cried out even more loudly, Son of David, have mercy on me. Jesus stood still and said, Call him here. And they called to the blind man, saying to him, Take heart, get up, he's calling you. Is the crowd fickle? First, they're telling him to shut up and stop making a nuisance of himself. There's the shame. And now when Jesus calls them, they say, Take heart, get up, he's calling you. There's the honour. Is the writer of Mark's Gospel pointing out the ambiguity that is part of the experience of our struggle? Shame seeks to silence us and press us down and keep us wallowing in our sense of helplessness. But honour, the honour that Christ calls us to, tells us to take heart and get up in continuing response to the summons. So throwing off his cloak, he sprang up and came to Jesus. Take notice of the cloak here. It's a symbol of security. Not only did it keep the blind beggar warm at night, but it's what he spread out amongst the stalls of the marketplace to collect the alms that people would offer him. He abandons the cloak. He leaves it aside. Abandoned in the midst of struggle, he takes a risk. We all take risks when we throw off our cloak of security. Sometimes they are foolhardy, but sometimes they are inspired. And this particular risk is in response to the summons. It is a well-discerned risk, even without sure knowledge of the outcome. And then Jesus said to him, What do you want me to do for you? The blind man said to him, My teacher, let me see again. Jesus said to him, Go, your faith has made you well. And immediately he regained his sight and followed him on the way. A few things to note here. Jesus says to him, What do you want me to do for you? Bartimaeus knows what he wants. Just previously, John and James knew what they wanted too. They wanted to be great. Give us positions of importance. Jesus' response to them was, can you drink the cup that I'm going to drink from? Can you be baptized with the baptism that I'm baptized with? John and James came asking, but they didn't know really what they were asking for. They eventually got what they asked for, but it wasn't in the way that they were anticipating it, because to be great is to be of service to the other. Sort of get a bit of a hint that Bartimaeus already knew this. In a way, he was already sighted. But Jesus feels inclined to ask him, what do you want me to do for you? It's a different way of approaching the teacher. That's how Bartimaeus sees him, the teacher. I follow the way that you teach. You are the teacher, I am your student. Let me see again. Seeing ahead, as I once saw before this struggle came upon me. Think of those Christians fleeing Rome. There was a time when they did see. That's why they're Christians. They're in Rome before Nero. Nero unleashes the persecution. Fear blinds them. Let me see again. Seeing ahead in the midst of struggle is the summons out of our blindness. And immediately he regained his sight and followed him on the way. There's the reward. We've had the summons, we've seen the struggle. Here's the reward. He sees again. The union and the response to service now takes place. Note that Bartimaeus is not off the hook with regard to the struggle that lies ahead. The way, very shortly in Mark's narrative, leads to the cross. But Bartimaeus' newfound sight will be very sorely tested as he joins Jesus on the roadway of service. So today's text calls us to address that cyclical nature of struggle and how to maintain our sight in its midst. The summons to follow the way of Christ is always there and inevitably lands us in a struggle to maintain our orientation as individuals, as households, and as communities of faith. Our struggles will yield moments of clarity and awareness of deep and intimate connection to the Christ with whom we travel, and we will find ourselves accordingly offering deeper service. I think perhaps I'll better stop there. And Luke did mention a Q&A session, so happy to engage with anything that, any way that you want to respond, actually, whether it's with a question or a comment. Does anyone know what happened to Bartimaeus afterwards? Does he ever get a mention again? He doesn't. But it's rather interesting, if you peel back the layers of the gospel, some have begun to think, Bartimaeus, it's a key feature of Mark's gospel. The fact that his name means something. Where else might he appear? And they've asked, who was the young man who fled naked from the Garden of Gethsemane, who also left his cloak behind? And who was the young man seated in the empty tomb of Jesus who said to the women who came to the tomb, he was dressed in a white robe? In the ancient church, that's a symbol of baptism. Dressed in a white robe, and he said to the women, go back to Nazareth, you will meet him there, and he'll tell you what to do. But not back to Nazareth, back to Galilee. And Galilee in Mark's Gospel is the place where ministry and mission and teaching happens. Call back to the way. So is Bartimaeus and the young man in Gethsemane who fled away naked, and the young man in the tomb, are they connected? I don't know. I love the I love ambiguity and open-endedness. Yeah, Zacchaeus in Luke's Gospel, which has a different timeline altogether and told in a different way. Well, yes, that's right. You've got that same, the elements of that story there. You've got summons, come down out of the tree. I'm going to be at your place today. You've got the struggle as Zacchaeus deals with all the beady eyes and the death stares that are following him. There's the almost a Eucharistic meal at his house, dining with Jesus. And then you've got the service. Everything I've taken, I'll give back four times over. Yeah, fascinating. Oh, right. I simply describe myself as an agent of a global enterprise.
Oh, you just that?
Yeah. I'll expand it a little bit, said what we did. You know, health education, community transformation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. There's two things I'd like to say there. This can mean two things, honour and shame. Often we let shame overcome us.
Okay, yes, it's a reality, and it's good if we can accept and engage that reality rather than try and deny that this doesn't happen to a good Christian. It does. When we acknowledge it, we can deal with it. We can say, well, okay, what is the summons? There is a summons that we can focus ourselves out of this, very soul-destroying experience that I'm having. Thank you.